Please join with me. Loving and gracious God, we give you thanks for this new year, this beginning, for your inbreaking spirit, for where we find you, where you've disclosed yourself to us in mysterious ways, in new ways, and sometimes even in old familiar ways that we have forgotten. God, we ask that you reveal yourself to us through our meditations, through the words of my mouth. May they be acceptable in your sight. Continue to pour your spirit upon us that we may learn. We may continue to discover you in all of these ways. For you are this great, for you are this continuing wisdom that goes with us and through us and all in this rich variety of ways. Help us to understand. We ask this in the name of your Son, Jesus. Amen. This is supposedly my final farewell testimony, but I might be back in 6 months. I know that's an oxymoron, but I am leaving and starting an interim pastor position at a church in Apple Valley on January 16th. And I have been here with my family since October of 2008. It's been 11 years. No, 11 years, sorry. 3 years, thank you. Yeah, sorry, Asians are not all good at math. Or as my wife says, I'm the only Asian who's not good at math. We've been here for 3 years. It's felt like 11. No, didn't work. But we've been here, and we came from San Francisco, and we were looking for a church. And on the website, and I know I did not say this, but I think Jen put it up there, that this is the church of my dreams, the church that I've always been dreaming of. I've never said that. I know I never said that. I thought it. But see there, get out of my head. But he knew that this was, after talking with Jen, one of the first times that I was here, that this was a place that was safe for me and also for my family. That one of the things that we came here from San Francisco, which was very diverse, and I had lived there for 18 years, was, and the first, and this is the one indication that I knew that this was a good place, was that we came and walked in the morning. We had been trying so many different churches, because there were so many different kinds of churches here in the Twin Cities. That we walked in and we sat down, and then my wife got the kids to the nursery, and she came back into the back of the sanctuary, and she was looking. And usually with every other church that in the Twin Cities that I've been in, it's pretty easy to tell. There's my husband, the one with the black straight hair, sitting right there in a field of, you know, blondes, brown-haired Norwegians, or either African-Americans as well, and it's like, that's my husband right there. When she came back into the back of the sanctuary, she was like, where's my husband? What did he wear today? That's the only way I can tell him now, as far as in this sea of diversity. And it was a place for us where it was safe. It was the place where we felt at home, particularly coming from San Francisco. And it's been a great 3 years. And it also has been safe for me in other ways, too. I am an ordained pastor in the Presbyterian Church, something that I'm not always comfortable sharing with other folks, because I think, as you've heard me say before, I really don't like pastors. They bother me to a large extent, and I have to classify myself as one of them. But it has been a playground for me, and as I've told Jen in the beginning, this is, for Evelyn and for me, this is our sandbox, that there were issues in terms of being a pastor for me that still are not easy, that I have to live with constantly. And it has been a time of trial and experimentation and feeling out, what does this all mean? Between Evelyn and myself, and also with the help of Pastor Jen and the interns, seeing what that role is, or what that place that God has called me to as well. I chose two passages because I couldn't decide which one. And also, just to confuse you, maybe I was thinking we should just keep reading scripture for my final testimony so I don't have to preach. But these two passages in particular, and Epiphany in general, is something that's very meaningful for me. Epiphany literally means the appearance or the manifestation of a divine presence. It can also mean like the sudden appearance of the essential nature or meaning of something. And this epiphany which we have gathered are these wise men, these magi, who have come from the east to disclose and see that God is here, that the Messiah is born, that Christ is here, and to bear witness to this. We've come across this epiphany, you know, years and years for many of us, and we've heard the story. I like the story in particular because after I found this out, I was like, oh, I really like this story. Matthew, in his divine wisdom, has placed these magi here, these Zoroastrians, these astrologers who have forecasted the future based on the movement of the stars. The history of Zoroastrianism is, and it still goes on today, they come from Persia, which we know as Iran. And it's a long history of philosophy, of religion. But Matthew places them in here, and in the Greek, magi, it doesn't simply mean wise men, but it does mean these kind of sorcerers. And if we know our scripture, it says in Deuteronomy, that in chapter 18, that sorcerers are supposed to be put to death. They're an abomination before God. And Matthew has stuck them in the middle of this story. Why would we put these three blasphemous figures here in the epiphany, in the inbreaking and the manifestation of God, to bear witness, to be close, to want to be one of the first few people in Matthew's gospel to come to God and to say, this is God's presence here on earth. I loved it in the sense of that Matthew has this kind of, this very Jewish sense of, you know, who Jesus is, the lineage that is given before this, but he sticks in these weird, very, very polluted, very tainted, very dirty or unclean players, Tamar, the prostitute, and he says in here, David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah, which we all know is a euphemism for Bathsheba, which we know is adultery. That this long legacy that Jesus has come from, that Matthew has placed within this legacy, this genealogy of these supposedly unclean or inappropriate people to be here. And I can't think of a Christmas that does not have an inappropriate person in it. Particularly if you have come from seeing family, as I've just asked somebody coming from their family trip. How did it go? I survived. That we have these rough edges with our families and everything else that we see, that we rub up against, that sometimes, you know, give us these paper cuts constantly, or sometimes more, a worse wound. But that this time of Christmas for us, this sign of the Epiphany for Matthew, has this very rough edge of family history, and also this inclusion of these Zoroastrians, these magi, these unclean people, to pay homage to Christ. I like that passage because for me in particular, the church and you all are an embodiment of these rough edges. To see it says, we were looking at this passage in Ephesians, Paul says the rich manifold wisdom of God, the rich multi-variety wisdom of God, how it comes from all these different angles, more than we can even comprehend or imagine or hold on to, that God comes to us and says, I hold all of this, and that this church will be an embodiment and a testifying to God's wisdom, to all the rulers in their heavenly places, all of these people who are high above, princes and principalities. That in our rough-hewn nature as a church, particularly here at Cannes, that it has been an embodiment for me and my family to live out these places that are rough within us, to live out these places where we're not supposed to fit, or as a second-generation Chinese American, I should be an engineer or a math major or a lawyer or a doctor, and yet I shame my family. Well, shame, they're not really ashamed of me, into being a pastor. I love these passages because of the roughness that's there. For my final testimony, I was thinking, what should I, you know, how do I prop up CAN? How do I say how great this congregation has been? And I can go on and on, and I think we celebrate the anniversary next week as well, where we get to do that even more. But that's not the nature of CAN. The nature of CAN is to be honest and to put all of it out there and to realize that in the midst of all of this, there is a blessing that is here, that God lives here and is manifested here, not simply by one person or one idea, but by how we live with one another and how God lives between us. I am, as I said, I'm leaving to do this interim pastorship. My wife and I moved here in 2008, where I was a solo pastor in San Francisco. We moved here for a change in quality of life, where we could live off of one salary, that I could be home with my son for 3 years, through very formative years for him, that I get to see this, and it's a gift for us. But that we knew at the end of 3 years that he would go back to being in school full-time, and that, which probably meant for me, it's like, it'd probably be good if I started working again. So going back to the pastorate has been an exciting thing for me, and I got to do a little bit of that here in terms of being at CAN. And by Jen's grace, and also by the interns and also the other staff folks who are here, and the elders and the leaders of this church, allowing me to be pastor to some extent here. But to do this now in a different setting, I have to tell you that I'm both excited and I'm scared to death. Because church is not a safe place. Because church has rough-hewn edges. And the trick is, for any church, it's how honest you want to be with that, or how much do you want to cover it up so that no one else sees the skeletons in the closet, but that they start leaking out eventually and start giving each other paper cuts, or worse, deeper wounds. I grew up in Evansville, Indiana, and the first place that I remember experiencing the presence of God was in my youth group, both my junior high and my senior high youth group. And we were a weird mismatch of just strange personalities. Evansville, Indiana does not have a large Chinese or Asian population in general. And so I was one of a few folks there. But then in our youth group, we also had the pastor's son, you know, and most PKs, pastor's kids, except for Claire and Austin, are usually a little bizarre. My wife is a good example of that, in terms of rebelling against the authority of, like, my father's a pastor, so I have to behave. And it's, no, I'm not. In fact, I'm going to do everything opposite. We had the pastor's kid who was a punk rocker who wore eye mascara and had mohawks and black leather and chains to church every Sunday. And he was part of our youth group. We had other folks who were of different ethnicities. You know, one of my best friends was half Japanese, half German, German-American, and she was a war baby from World War II. I mean, from her parents in that sense. And then we had other folks who just didn't fit. We had, you know, popular athletes. We had people who were geeks. We had people who were totally book nerds. We had people who just had a different sense about them. And yet, when we lived together, every spring break, every spring vacation, for our vacation, we only had 1 week, it became a tradition for us to leave and go do a mission project somewhere. And we would go and have to decide on the menu together and what music we would listen to in a van ride all the way over to these places of New York City or New Mexico or Chicago. And being in a van, and I think the interns know this, being in a van, a smelly van with people who have different tastes than you, who like listening to different music, who like, you know, getting comfortable for 18 hours in a particular enclosed vehicle, is not a fun thing, much less living with them for a week. And the mission trips that we did were great in the sense of the work that we did, but we, you know, knowing then and knowing now also, it's like what we did is like we just put another brick in the wall. We built a room or we did this. It wasn't any great miracle or feat that we were helping someone out. It wasn't charity in that sense. In fact, the best gift that we had that kept us going every single spring break was the fact that by our time together, we would lay everything out. Every insecurity, every foible, every rough edge that we had to live with one another would be put out there. And it would have to come back to us in terms of like how we're living, that we had literally 18 to 20 other mirrors living with us that we couldn't escape from ourselves as well. I grew closer to those people than I have to anybody. They were my family. And when I was an insecure 14-year-old and so narcissistic that, particularly, here's one example of when my mother died when I was 14, during the visitation, I was literally keeping count in my head of how many friends visited, you know, at the viewing versus my sister's friends. As a 14-year-old at my mother's death. And yet these people who I went on these trips with stood by me, let me go through my period of like growing into myself when no one else, I couldn't even stand being around myself. That they would love me through this. That when I was 18 years old and questioning God, you know, and questioning the existence of this and seeing and knowing how my mother had died through 8 years of pain, of cancer and radiation treatment and chemotherapy, that they didn't sit there and try to prove to me the existence of God, even in my direct, you know, shaking my fist and disbelief. But they sat with me and loved me through it and let me ask the questions and let me explore with them. That in their presence there and in their patience, they continued to show and prove to me, even now after all these years, that God lived here, that God has been here all along. They were a living example for me of what church was, even though I didn't have the words for it then. And every year we went on these mission trips, it wasn't about, you know, doing the work. It was great that we were doing there and the communities were thankful, but it was more about learning from them and then consequently learning from these other communities that we went to do work with, that they were teaching us something that we never knew as far as gratitude, as far as being humble, as far as welcoming people in that you had no idea who they were. Even though we might have been totally acting out of a place of supremacy, that we were these, you know, middle class, very affluent, you know, kids from the suburbs. And yet they took us in and showed us what it meant to be humble, showed us what it meant to be hospitable, showed us what the love of Christ was and lived that with us without necessarily evangelizing to us. And it was at that point that I realized that this was church for me, and I've been leaving all these places trying to find where that is and have had hit or miss luck with that. But as my sister and some other people from that youth group grew up and became pastors, they were saying, you should be a pastor. As you've heard from other intern stories, it's like this exceptionalism. You're very bright. You should do this. We know you can't do math, but you should be a pastor instead because you have the gifts for this. And my whole life, I've said, no, I don't want to. And I don't think I've disclosed the reasons why I don't like pastors and why I don't like churches in particular. In my church, I grew up in a First Presbyterian church, which was, they call it, I don't know if you've seen that for some people who are not Presbyterian, they call them First Presbyterians because they're the first one established in the city. It was a sense of pride. Ours was a downtown, it was actually two buildings, one downtown, which where the city started, and the Presbyterian leaders were instrumental in helping to form that town and form the commerce in that town. Huge edifice, gigantic organ, and they had a second plant on the east side that was growing, where more families were living closer and closer out to the suburbs. We belonged to this church, and when I was 17 years old, I witnessed firsthand the splitting of a church, where people became so embroiled in this controversy of like how the pastor was leading and what the pastor should do, to the point of they said, we just can't live with each other anymore. We're going to dissolve this. The worst of human nature that comes out when you have to fight over a possession is more indicative, my feeling is, in a church that is splitting denominationally within a particular location than anywhere else. Because the true humanity and brokenness comes out. Things that were said that even, you know, I know now from people that they still had not reconciled with one another. And the ones that have felt so much remorse for saying things during the midst of that conflict, these broken relationships. that they realize they can't go to their grave holding on to this that they have. In that time, I witnessed my youth pastor have a nervous breakdown because of the politics that were going on. Had to sit there with the presbytery that came in with a commission that interviewed everybody to figure out what it was, and then to realize that the best solution was to dissolve this church. And then even after that, after dissolving 2 years later, the pastor who was the major focus of that conflict, who went to the other side of the town's church, that they kicked him out after 2 years also. It just continues to go on where it's like, who wants to be a pastor of that? Where supposedly we treat pastors really well, but really, as Pastor Jenna said, really, in our deep heart and nature, we kind of want to crucify who's ever in charge. We want someone to blame. We want someone to scapegoat. And I realized that's not where I want to be. Along with that, with my when my mother died, and the people that gathered around me that were family were there to console me, and I could not answer this mystery of why good people die, this theodicy question of whether God is both fair and sovereign over all. They weren't trying to. But when the pastor came in, who I had no, not my youth pastor, but the head pastor came in and I had no connection or feeling with, that his awkwardness around our grief was so much, so palpable for me that it still sticks with my head of like, I have this visceral reaction with, and this is just me, with pastors who wear dress shoes and black socks to everything. Because that's, I remember looking ahead at his shoes going, why are you even here? Why are you trying to explain my grief to me when you don't know the depths of how hurt I feel and where I feel lost in all of this? And I haven't seen you or witnessed you or had any relationship with you for 15 years. And you're here now with your black shoes and your dress socks trying to explain the mysteries of God to me and looking at your watch trying to get out of our house as fast as you possibly can because it's so uncomfortable for you because you know it and I know it. That we're not connected in any way. Why would I want to be a pastor who is like this? My good friend, probably one of my best friends ever, is Bruce Reyes Chow. He used to be the moderator of the Presbyterian Church, USA, whatever that means. And we went through a period where he went to seminary first. He was also one of those people poking me, saying, you should go to seminary. And I was like, to do what you do? You're crazy. And his first church, he said, you know, I wasn't ordained, but I was like, why don't you come to the youth group because we did youth ministry together. Okay, I'll come to your youth group. And he had this fairly new church development. This is where Evelyn and I met in San Francisco at Covenant Presbyterian Church. And Bruce was changing things. He was like not preaching from the pulpit. He wasn't wearing his robe. He was, you know, getting up and walking around. He was making us play different music, which I loved, and Evelyn and I both were part of. And all of these young families were starting to come to this church, and it was being revitalized because it was an old church that had died, basically. And then they asked him to come and form this between, you know, families, because there were a lot of Chinese families in the area, from Chinatown Presbyterian Church. They lent them some families to help plant. And then he started bringing in other families who weren't Chinese American from the community in. And the church started growing. And Bruce only lasted there 5 years. I only lasted there for about four. Mainly because when these young people started coming in, these questions started happening. The music's too loud. Why do you keep moving around the pulpit? I can't keep track of you. You keep walking around. Why do you keep preaching, you know, this particular gospel? Why do you keep talking about these sermons? Why aren't you wearing your robe? We never did it like that before. I don't think we were supposed to do it like that. Does the Book of Order say that? That there was this tension that was building up, and eventually to the point of where I saw Bruce basically starting to have an ulcer, starting to be hospitalized, you know, for, they call it gastroenteritis, but it's really, it's like a lot of it is exacerbated by stress in terms of his insides basically squeezing themselves to the point of where he left. And I made a deal with him. It's like, I need to leave first before you go. Just promise me that. And I was thinking about seminary during one part, and I finally agreed to go, but I said, I'm never going to be a congregational pastor, seeing what you go through. Seeing what these people want to crucify you for. Why would I want to be anything that these people that, you know, you can't pay me enough? And on top of it, you know, do you get to the point where you get so jaded that you're looking at your watch trying to get out of meetings? That all it's about is wearing the black shoes and the dress socks and protecting what's yours and protecting the status quo? That church split also. And I, in spite of all this, I still heard this calling, and I'm not going to put that in the sermon today. But I had to deal with my wife, because I was like, I said every year, and I thank her for being patient with me, because I said every year that I'm in seminary, I have an out, right? I can quit whenever I want to, right? Even though I'm not really making a whole lot of money, and we're getting deeper and deeper into our relationship. Is that okay? Can I quit every year? Can I have that out? And she would patiently shake her head and say, yes, if you want to every year, you can quit seminary. If you start losing the point of why you're here or any passion of why you're here, you can quit. I was like, good, thank you. And I know now in the back of her head, she's like, this guy's crazy. And it was the last thing in her mind to marry somebody who was a seminarian or was going to be a pastor also, having been a pastor's kid. But every year I gave myself that out because I said, I made a deal with God, and I don't make these deals anymore. I said, God, I sincerely do not want to be a congregational pastor because of this history. And I tried everything. I tried to, I had a thought about being a PhD candidate and getting my doctorate, about possibly teaching after that, about working in nonprofit work after that, anything. I was trying to, they call it circling your list or crossing stuff off. I was trying so desperately to cross off congregational pastor. I even did it, you know, these field visits where it's like I was going to observe other people doing it, and I was like, yeah, I'm not doing that. That's crazy. But every single year, there would be something where someone would say, you know, you need to think about this. And I would say very vehemently, I'm not doing this. Because of the black shoes and the dress socks, because of, you know, watching this church split, I'm not doing this. I even, after graduating seminary, took an internship, or not an internship, but a CP position, but eventually a full-time staff position as a chaplain in a hospital, trying to run away from this ministry. But as we know, we make plans and God laughs. I eventually felt called and compelled to be in this one church, Bethany Presbyterian, and to say, and my friend Bruce and everybody else was saying, you don't have to do it like us. Just do it and find out and just experiment, which is what I did. And we lived in this one church for 4 years. And I had this rule, you know, that I got from Evelyn and I got from the gospel in particular, but we had this rule between ourselves and the other elders that if we ever were acting from a place of looking good, being right, or being in control, that those were our three canaries in the coal mine, which would indicate to us that we're not living by the gospel, that we are trying to live out from this place that I think Jen and this congregation puts on it so well, that we're trying to live out this heroism project of keeping our legacy intact and not really trusting God. And for 2.5 of those years, it was, for me, an invigorating time that I kept saying, really? I'm a congregational pastor even though I drag my heels all this time? And there was a new energy that was happening and there were new families that were coming in and something was going on. But at 2.5 years, and I can see it now with different eyes to some extent, but it's still the wounds are fresh, that I was challenged by the charter member of the church, the biggest giver of the church, and the lifelong Presbyterian of the church, all who sat on the personnel committee and started questioning me as far as, you make too much money. We've given you too much money for your study leave. What are you doing with all your time? You can't possibly be working this much. Why don't you wear a robe anymore? Why do you keep moving around in the pulpit? Why do you keep changing the configuration? At that time, we had chairs, not pews, that would move around. Why do you keep changing the configuration? And what's with this music that, you know, that's too loud? And it came to a point of where we butted heads, and I let them go. I was too compliant with letting them do whatever they wanted to do. That the final act for me, as far as being a pastor, that I necessarily had not bought into, was also putting my authority and saying, this is not how we act with one another. That when someone is acting from a place of being right, being in control, or their own self-appearance to other people, that it was also my job to call them on this and say, this is not how we live. This is not how we will be. That once we start doing this, the manifestation of God and how we live with each other will not be here anymore. So after a year and a half of fighting, and it somewhat subsided, and we had to call the presbytery in to negotiate the conflict. And we thought everything had settled down. Evelyn got a job position and an offer here to be in Minnesota, back in her hometown, which after prayerfully thinking about and after being run down and having a knot in my back for the last year, said, okay, I feel like a failure that I'm leaving this church, that we had come to this point, that we had crossed all these bridges together, that new people were coming, but that I was a failure in leaving. But at the same time, convinced myself and my family that being here for Soren and watching him grow up until he was 4 would be the best thing for us. But the realization is that when we came here, even though it's really far from our house, it's not convenient to be here, that this became our playground and our sandbox to experiment and see, how do we live out this balance of family? How do I go back to the congregation that Paul says with complete confidence, which I find utterly ridiculous, that the church will be the divine manifestation. The church will be the embodiment of the manifold wisdom, the multi-variety, the rich diversity of God's wisdom to the rulers in the heavenly places. This ultimate paradox of where people, and you all know who you are, and I'm not going to say you by name, but some of you all are prickly. Some of you all have rough edges. Some of you have given me paper cuts, even in the 3 years that I've been here. And if they've given me paper cuts, I can imagine what you've gone through in terms of, like, you've got bigger wounds than that. But that there's more than just the paper cuts, and it's more than suppressing it, and it's more than just being half in, but it's about how we are going to live with each other. That being called to this for me scares the life out of me, and I worry still about our family. I still worry about, you know, for Ev and me, in terms of, like, how we're going to deal this with our kids now, even though they're grown and they're going to school full time. And yet God says that I'm going to pull in as many people into this story and include them as possible. That this is the mystery that Paul is talking about, that all of us are welcome here, and that somehow that we will give glory, we will be overwhelmed by joy, as it says in Matthew, to pay tribute and homage to God, but that the rulers, the Herods in our lives, and they might be the founding member, they might be the longtime Presbyterian, they might be the biggest giver, these rulers in our heavenly places, that we will not, as Jen says, bow to empire, that we are not here to build up the status quo, but that you all have lived this for my family, and that I have appreciated this, and I have loved this, and it scared me even more going back into a world which does not even operate from the same place. But that this is the hopefulness of going back into the pastorate for me, which is, this is who I am. This is all I can do. And as some of you know, I'm either all in or I'm not in at all.
that I take each one of you with me, and I take the paper cuts, and I take the hard edges, and I take the places where it is not easy, and it hasn't been easy for us as we've lost members, if we've gained members, if we've gone through these ebbs and flows. That you all have witnessed to me the divine manifestation of God, not by one person, not by simple acts or beliefs that you have, but by how you have lived with each other. And to this I'm thankful. Thank you all. Please pray with me. Gracious God, you have called us each to ministry in different ways, in different varieties of coming to you and also proclaiming and testifying who we are, how you have been faithful in our lives. But God, you tell us even more so that as we come, that we are the ones who are the soothsayers, the ones who should be left out of the story, the ones who should be blasphemous, the ones who are broken, not yet healed. You come to tell us that you have included us through your Son, Christ Jesus, that he is our Messiah and the only hope that we can possibly have, not by our hands, not by our will, not by how big our steeple is, not by how large our congregation will grow, but more so how we begin to live that truth with one another, how we make room for it, how we let it breathe, how we let it change us. I give you thanks for this congregation, for all the rough-hewn ways that you have gathered them, for adding ourselves to this as well, to let us play and experiment, to not necessarily have the answers to each one of these questions, but to find you and to find the peace that you offer us that surpasses all understanding. Peace in the midst of conflict, peace in the midst of diversity, peace in the midst of pieces that seem mismatched, that shouldn't be together, but that somehow you have drawn together to make your own, your body, your family. God, help us to live this out as we celebrate another year of our life together. Let us know that it is not about us. Continue to remind us that it is always about you and how you have put these things together. We ask this. We ask for this epiphany constantly. In the name of your Son, amen.